That was great, Todd. I really enjoyed it. In Acts 9, I'm not sure. I think you made the break between verse 19 and 20, meaning Paul goes into Arabia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would like to suggest you think about something. The NIV, which I don't often quote for good advice, but they make the break in the middle of verse 19, which I think is probably correct. Because the last sentence of verse 19 says, then Paul spent some days with the disciples at Damascus. And if that is true immediately upon his baptism, what would they have been talking to him about besides the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus? And yet he says in Galatians 1, I certify to you, I did not receive this from men, but I received it from the Lord himself. I really think probably that the chronological break appears in the middle of verse 19. Not that that's a whole lot different from what you said. And then, you know, Paul goes into Arabia,
mm-hmm.
and he spends 3 years there, or most of 3 years, before he goes up to Jerusalem. I think that's significant. There are no churches in Arabia that we know anything about. I don't think he's in Arabia preaching. I think he's in Arabia receiving the revelation from the Lord. And that it took 3 years should not be surprising. It took the other apostles 3 years to be ready to go out into the world. And besides that, we need to allow for Paul's psychological change. Now, I believe he was totally converted when he was baptized. I believe he believed in Jesus. But now he had to have some time to come to grips with what he had been doing to Christians and forgive himself. And I think that, coupled with the revelation, explains the 3 years in Arabia. So anyway, you might consider that there. But also, I wanted to underline what you said about Galatians 2 and the second trip to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Paul did not go up to Jerusalem to find out if what he had been preaching about the Gentiles not having to keep the law was true. Paul was an apostle. He went up to Jerusalem to say, these Judaizers say that you guys sent them out from Jerusalem. If you didn't, this is what they're teaching up there, and it's false doctrine. If you did, you need to do something about it. That's what he went to Jerusalem for. There was no question that Paul was preaching the truth, not in his mind or Barnabas's or the church in Jerusalem for that matter. Good job.
Brother Todd, thank you. Very good. That of the people that were living in the area at the time of the Lord's crucifixion and resurrection that wanted to deny it, I think the Apostle Peter really put the challenge to the people. As you read through Acts, there's a number of times when he's preaching, he speaks about this Jesus, and you can almost picture him pointing his finger, him saying that you crucified, God raised up. And he says that over and over again, and saying, and he is our Lord. So there had to have been groups of people going around, we've got to prove this guy wrong. And even today in law and in forensic science, they say it's hard to get rid of a body. And they were looking for the body. When Peter was preaching to Cornelius, he was making the same point, but he didn't say that you crucified. He says this same Jesus that the Jews killed, God raised him up. And over again, he was giving that to the people. So all they had to do was prove it wrong, produce the body. And if anybody could have done it, would have been those people that lived right then. And he just proved it over and over again. The Lord has been raised. And that same evidence is being put before the people today. So that's just one thing I like. I think it shows the human preaching and the way of Paul and Peter and the truth, and still just putting that challenge to the people over and over again. And of course, they couldn't do it. And also, I appreciate you pointing out that whether it be Paul or any of the rest of them, it wasn't just on their own investigation and their own research that they produced and preached the scriptures, but it's the inspiration. Yes. And Paul stated that several times, always like Ephesians 3, where he told the Ephesians the same thing. He received it by revelation. He wrote it down. They could read it and understand. But thank you very much.
Excellent job. Yeah, very good. You introduced kind of your thoughts with the idea that each of those points were significant to prove the death of Christ as well as the burial and the resurrection. Many have not had opportunities to preach to groups or Islamic people about these facts. I mean, other than, you know, whenever we have the opportunity to take it. But what has been your response? I mean, I'm asking to continue on from your information. What kind of response have you had to giving this information? Have other issues then come up, or do they try to defend against that and say that this testimony is somehow inferior, incorrect, or flawed?
With my Muslim students, they either agree with what I'm saying, or with this last one I mentioned, they go back to get more ammunition. I know this guy will be back again. We have a kind of past 2 years, like a tennis match going. The disturbing thing, I think, is that this guy, he's an advanced student. Usually when I get questions about whether God exists, things like that, is God a monster for doing X, Y, and Z to the people in the Old Testament? It's from the advanced students, the people who are going to be, the people who get accepted to the military academy and Stanford. I mean, they're going to be leaders who have doubts about the resurrection, doubts about the existence of God. That's disturbing. But sometimes they've sent me back and I've gotten more ammunition. But at this point, I'm able to field a lot of their questions and handle them. But it's probably 50-50. They agree or they come back with more ammunition.
Very good, as always. This year, I read the book Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus by Nabil Qureshi. And he explains that among the various sects of Islam, there are different official theories as to what happened to Jesus. The Ahmadi Muslims that he belonged to hold the swoon theory. The largest sect of Islam believes that Judas was crucified, and God miraculously put Jesus' face on Judas's body, and that's what happened. But it's interesting, in that book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, you learn that Gary Habermas and Michael Icona, who you mentioned today, helped convert Nabil Qureshi out of Islam. They were present for those Bible studies. And they've written some of the most popular books on the resurrection in modern literature. Everybody's reading their stuff. And it was very interesting to me to hear some of the points they made that you addressed, and I thought addressed very well, very troublesome arguments that they would be making. But I wasn't altogether shocked because Michael Icona, whose book is very, very popular, also holds another theory that the Gospels are a form of Greco-Roman biography that allow the Gospel writers to tell a story in a way they know is false in order to illustrate some point about the character of Jesus. There's been a book just recently published called The Mirror and the Mask by Lydia McGrew that really analyzes and exposes the problem of Michael Icona's approach to the Gospels. And I just thought that was so important. A lot of young people are reading Lycona and Habermas and thinking, these guys are the cat's meow when it comes to helping us know the truth of the resurrection. But they've bought into some destructive theories, and we've got to be very cautious about that. Is there anything else that you picked up on besides that apostolic formula origin theory that you would warn us against in popular writings on the resurrection that might be subtly destructive?
The only thing I didn't go into, and you could Google this, you could get the book Gary Habermas wrote with Michael Icona, The Case for the Resurrection, is the minimal facts. You ever read this theory? Where he only takes the New Testament books that the skeptics will allow him to take. And among those is 1 Corinthians and Galatians. I believe the skeptics give him Romans, and he tries to build his case for the resurrection with just those books. But they don't allow Acts and Luke, but the other skeptic says that Luke, who wrote both of those books, is a top-notch historian. Why wouldn't you use those books? Why would you leave those out? Maybe it's out of convenience. But the minimal facts theory, I think somebody should speak on that one year, is one of the limiting, narrow-minded views of at least those two guys. The other guy that I mentioned, Frank Turek, who was right along the same lines as these guys, same school of thought, tours college campuses. And he wrote a bestseller. I mean, I was telling guys, if you haven't run into it, you will. It's out there. There are two seminaries in Louisville, where I live, kitty corner from each other. One's a major seminary, and one's not so major. But if you go in their bookstores, which I do, they have these books prominently displayed, and people are devouring these books. So, yeah, the minimal facts theory, I think, would be the other thing to look into.
Well, then, springboarding off what Clint said, is there any value into reading these books by Craig and Habermas and the rest?
If I were to list them, I'd put William Lane Craig at the top. He's, when it comes to answering arguments about the problem of evil, when it comes to answering arguments about the existence of God, I've seen him in debates. I've never seen him lose. He's, as my students would say, the bomb. But when it comes to the resurrection and the facts of the resurrection, where Paul received what he delivered, they all believe the same thing. William Lane Craig, Frank Turek, Michael Icona, Gary Habermas, they all believe he got it from his visit to Jerusalem. That, and then of course there's, I have seen William Lane Craig preach a sermon, and at the end, dim the lights and pray and ask Jesus into your heart. So the plan of salvation is off. And William Lane Craig, interestingly, when he was asked what separated him from everybody else, he said, I'm not a Calvinist. I found that interesting. If you were going to watch a debate by William Lane Craig, I would pull up the one between William Lane Craig and who's the famous atheist? He's dead now.
Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah. I bet he's a believer now, but pull up that debate and Chris Hitchens is one of their champions. When I first became a school teacher, there were two atheists that I worked with who just fawned over Christopher Hitchens. And William Lane Craig dispatches him with intellectual ease.
Nathan Bennett.
Thanks, brother. I enjoy that a lot. I was just going to mention, you brought up the evidence for the crucifixion of Jesus as far as the process that goes on. I just want to make a book recommendation for folks. Dr. Frederick Zugby wrote a book called The Crucifixion of Christ that I believe is the best on the subject. A lot of what we hear, a lot of what I've taught in the past, is came from Dr. Pierre Barbet, who's a French doctor who did experimentation on what would be entailed in the process of crucifixion. And what Dr. Zugby does in his book is he examines the methodology used by Pierre Barbet and shows that a lot of it was flawed. And as a result, some of the information that has been built off of his expose has been flawed. And Zugby presents, I believe, a much stronger case and better experimentation to go along and to back his critique of Barbet. And I didn't realize how much of what I had heard and even taught had been influenced by Barbet. But everybody's been basically regurgitating Barbet through the years. And Zugby, who is a medical coroner in the state of New York, has written a really strong, I think a masterful case that is much better than Barbet and is worth considering and reading.
Matthew Schaefer.
Now, I noticed in 1 Corinthians 15 and 5, it's noted that he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12, then later in verse 7, after that he was seen by James, then by all the apostles. Do you believe that that's simply a reduplication of the same group that saw Christ, or did you come across any explanation?
I thought I was ready for everything. No. Let me look at that again. I said no initially, thinking disciples would just be followers. Not sure. Not sure. He says the 12, and I mentioned up here, I think that means the 11. But then he says the apostles. I don't know if you extend that thought I set forth about the Big Ten being actually 14 teams. The 12, I don't know how true this could be, might be actually, you know, any number of disciples, followers of Christ, a general number. I'm not sure. That's a good question. Brother Bonifay wants.
Nobody else right now. Let me,
I think that's probably just a sequential list there. It's possible that the last term, all the apostles, might include Matthias, who by the time he writes is an apostle, but when he saw him.
Oh, that's a good point, too.
But it's probably just a sequential list. The apostles saw Jesus more than once after the resurrection. And so he was seen by Cephas, by the 12, by 500, by James, by the apostles again, by me.
Good job, sir. You're making my topic much easier. And would you be willing to stand in for the Q&A whenever I'm finished with my presentation? In considering this material, what do you think, in your opinion, is the most compelling piece of evidence for the resurrection?
The empty tomb. I think that's the most compelling. The fact that the tomb was empty, that the You know, if a skeptic argues that the 500 who saw him, as the skeptic has argued, were hallucinating, that still doesn't answer the fact that the tomb is empty. The skeptics who say the apostles came and stole the body and who apparently said that for two centuries, they're just acknowledging that the tomb is empty. And they would have to take into account that there are people who are walking around that said that they saw him. And then they would have to take into account that stolen bodies don't change lives, especially if you're in on the stealing of the body, a disciple who stole the body. The tomb was empty. People said they saw him. It transformed lives. And they would have to also account for the fact that the Christian movement, as they call it, took place around the scene of the crime, Jerusalem, where all this stuff took place. And Peter's sermon. He's standing there preaching at the scene of the crime that Christ, that Jesus is Christ, that the one you killed, God rose, caused him to be raised from the dead, that we saw it, and that if you don't believe me, we know where the tomb is, it's empty. What's the best explanation for the transformed lives, for the bold preaching of Peter, and for the empty tomb? And if we believe in God, then raising someone from the dead is child's play. You know what I mean?
So let me, names here, what can raise your hand, let me make a request. First of all, that's the exact point that Paul made to King Agrippa.
Yeah.
Believes that. It's incredible that God raises the dead.
Yeah.
That takes care of all your problems with miracles, with creation, with judgment. There's a God. All this is indeed possible. But you've mentioned William Lane Craig, Gary Habermas, Michael Lincona. There are some problems and issues there. Years ago, when I got started in an interest in apologetics and the resurrection, I used Josh McDowell's book. And you can imagine when I got to the end and saw the four spiritual laws, that was somewhat dismaying. So I've never handed that book to others.
Right.
Because of that. He's got some other material out that is pretty good. And I think there's a lot of things in Craig and Habermas and Lincona that are useful. But for the help of everyone, especially these young fellows, maybe some of you others can contribute to this. Who would you recommend as a first read or some good material to get into this, and to be able to equip yourself to defend the resurrection and other apologetic issues?
On Guard is good by William Lane Craig. On Guard. It's basically chapter after chapter of arguments, you know, addressing the problem of evil, the existence of God, the resurrection, and it's pretty neutral as far as, and he's not a Calvinist. You get, huh?
What's his name?
William Lane Craig, On Guard. And then Josh McDowell did do another book that's a shortened version of Evidence That Demands a Verdict that only deals with Christ, the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. I forgot the name of that.
Resurrection Factor.
Well, there's that one.
One of the current.
Not that one. It's
he's written a lot.
There's another one. It's just, I think it's called Evidence for Christianity. Okay. But it's a shortened version of his, the one you mentioned is
basically
thick.
A lot of his material has been recycled and repackaged in other books that have been published. So, I would like to take the opportunity. One source that I found always useful is Apologetics Press. Yeah. It is an organization affiliated with our Cups and Classes brethren. They're not too popular among the mainstream Cups and Classes brethren because they hold to views that are considered uneducated by a lot of those people nowadays, but I have always found their material generally reliable, and they've got some good books, especially for young people Reasons to Believe, and Answers for Skeptics, and those are a couple of titles. You can find that material very easily, and a lot of it in free format, PDF files, or in articles from their publications, which have been going on for years, at apologeticspress.org. Not sanctioning everything that they have on their site or that they teach, but I found that a pretty good, reliable source. And they'll also help with other subjects just then besides the resurrection. Do we have anybody else?
Thanks, brother. When you were describing the four-line formula and that idea, it made me think of HBRC BAP, when people sometimes write that on the board. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but this just sort of our formalized way of just stating the facts succinctly, and then we go in and we explain them. My question is, in anticipating maybe handling that when somebody expresses it, is the danger in that saying that that oral tradition existed and using 1 Corinthians 15 as evidence, or is the danger simply saying that that's where Paul received it, since he obviously received it straight from the Lord? So in other words, would it be okay to say, well, yeah, maybe there was this oral tradition and that demonstrates that these facts were believed early, but even if it was, Paul arrived at his, you know, Paul got his revelation independently?
I thought about that. It would be, I guess I'd be more comfortable thinking that Paul received it from the Lord, and that four-line formula didn't violate the scriptures or what the Lord had told him. But also the idea that I just briefly mentioned is that we are to stand fast and hold to the traditions that we have heard, whether by word or epistle, that could have come from an apostle teaching, because William Lane Craig even says it could have been used in Christian instruction. It could have come from an apostle who was teaching around that time shortly after the resurrection, that four-line formula. And it could have come from an apostle who took into account that the majority of the people he's teaching are illiterate, and they would have been able to memorize this rhythmic four-line phraseology.